Pegged GOP takeover several years ago. This year, they have been discussing bills on sales tax redistribution, religious freedom proposals, changes to the way highway funds are collected through the gas tax, eminent domain, and more. There's so much going on that we thought we'd step back and take stock with several reporters who cover all this on a regular basis. We are very happy that they've returned today because we were supposed to have done this show on Wednesday, but we had a technical problem, so they're here with us this morning. We're joined this hour by WFAE's Tom Bullock. We made him come back.
How are you, Mike?
Welcome. Eric Spanberg is senior staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal. Thank you for being so flexible.
Good to see you.
And particularly to Tim Boyum, who talks about all of this with official Raleigh every day as the anchor of Capital Tonight on Time Warner Cable News, which is a statewide broadcast, and he is on vacation, so he's been really flexible. Tim, thank you for coming back.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Wednesday was April 15th, tax day, and by now, most people had filed their taxes in South Carolina, North Carolina. They knew what their tax bill was going to be. They knew whether or not they were probably going to get a refund. Given the changes in North Carolina tax law that the legislature enacted, do we know yet if the average person came out better than they have in the past? Are they going to be surprised positively or negatively?
We seem to have anecdotal evidence that that the most affluent taxpayers did much better than the middle income and lower income.
Was that the intent? Was that as it was advertised?
No, the argument from the Republicans who passed tax reform and backed it was that this would benefit everybody, and that part of the fix here would be you would have a higher standard deduction, and so that would help you, and that would offset any of the things that were lost, such as the earned income tax credit, child care credit, and things like that. They're also having a lot of trouble with senior citizens who are frustrated by the end of medical expense deductions. So, and on that one, some Republicans have said, you know, maybe we need to revisit that. So when you look at this, Mike, and when you talk about it right now, it is very much, if you're a Republican, you think it's working. And if you're a Democrat, you're complaining that this is something that is just for plutocrats and it's not helping the broader population.
But I think the bigger question, Mike, also is how much revenue the state's going to be getting in. I mean, these tax cuts come with a price. They come with less revenue for the state. And everybody knew that there was going to be less revenue, but the state has yet to meet the expectations of revenue pulled in under these tax cuts. Now, it's getting closer and closer, but the trick is that until we see exactly what came in on April 15th, we're not really going to know whether or not what the financial footing of the state really is.
What are you hearing from Republicans and Democrats that you talk to every day on your television program, Tim, about these tax cuts and the restructuring of the tax code so far?
Well, Eric's right. The spin is the word of the day, the word of the year. The real challenge here is that people are used to getting refunds, and they don't pay attention to the news. They don't know the changes, so they're very upset when the refunds are smaller. Mm-hmm. A lot of people saw smaller refunds, including myself. However, 2014 in January, most people saw an increase in their paychecks, so that was incremental over time. But those people aren't adding up that over the 2-year period and seeing where they are.
If you're getting more back in your paycheck but a lower refund, you're actually not giving the loan to North Carolina that you were giving to them in the past.
And that's what the Republicans exactly what they're arguing. The problem is that we don't know, and I don't know how we'll ever truly know for individuals unless we polled every single person and checked their paychecks for the last 2 years about exactly who got better. Yes, the richer are going to get more money back, but they also pay more money in. So the proportion of that's going to be much higher. The Democrats will argue, you know, they should be paying more of their fair share. I mean, a lot of this resorts back to the traditional differences between Democrats and Republicans. As far as any deficit that's occurring, everybody, I've talked to the state budget director weekly on this. He feels that we're going to be right in the same range of where we've been the last couple months. They don't expect an April surprise for the bad. If they see an April surprise, they think it actually could be for the better.
Because NC Pulse, which describes itself as a nonpartisan blog run by the NC Policy Watch organization, which in turn describes itself as a progressive, nonprofit, nonpartisan public policy organization and news outlet.
Yeah,
right. They have complained of revenue shortfalls resulting from tax cuts that passed in 2013. And I asked Governor McCrory when he was on this program about that, and he flatly denied any revenue decline.
It's not happening. In fact, our revenue stream is coming in pretty good. Now, we did anticipate somewhat of a revenue deficit because I had to make a compromise. But fact of the matter is the economy is recovering and we're getting more money in than we ever anticipated.
Now, Tom, in a report that you aired just after that conversation occurred here, you said, and I quote, "That's not true."
And it's not. But as Tim just said, that gap seems to be closing. And the reason that I say that it's not true is quite simply that the Fiscal Research Division projected out what the revenue would be, and the revenue has yet to meet that expected target. So it is not true. However, again, that gap seems to be coming, you know, closer to being met. So we'll, as Tim just laid out, we'll see exactly what happens this April. And since it's, you know, shrinking, mm-hmm. they may in fact be in good fiscal shape.
You know, Mike, one of the things that's interesting here, and you may have this on your list, is Republicans don't even agree among – they agree on the tax reform, but what they don't agree on is how much more tax reform is needed. And that also ties into some of the sales tax mm-hmm. proposals yeah. that we're seeing this time around. And one of the things that you're hearing from people like Bob Rucho, who's a Mecklenburg Republican, is he wants to expand the taxes paid on services, which has traditionally been largely unscathed, untapped
yeah.
part of North Carolina. He wants to expand that greatly. And his idea is that by doing that, of course, people have more money in their pockets, but you could also further lower your income tax rates. And so that is part of the fight that we're going to see going on here.
Go ahead, Tim.
I was just going to say, and just to add to that, what he's talking about, the divide is, there's a certain, including Bob Rucho and some of the Republicans in the Senate, that say, we need, it's working, we need to keep moving forward. In fact, Senator Rucho has filed a bill that does reduce the corporate and income tax again. It doesn't get it to zero like he really wants, but it moves closer. Then there's another group of Republicans, including Governor McCrory, at least last time I talked to him, that say, whoa, we just made some major changes. We're not 100% certain exactly how this is going to impact the budget and revenue. So let this weigh out at least another year and see what happens before we move forward on any other tax changes. And some of them are so emphatic that they don't even want to change the sales tax. So this is a massive internal debate going on in the caucus meetings. In fact, last week when they were on quote-unquote spring break, there was caucus meetings going on with the Senate Republicans, and it was pretty feisty about what to do with taxes.
Well, Tim, both you and Eric have mentioned Bob Rucho from Mecklenburg County. He's the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, and a couple of years ago, I think 2013, he said that he hoped to use the 2015 legislative session to eliminate the state income tax altogether, replacing it with a consumption-based sales tax to make up for the lost revenue. Whatever happened to that approach?
Well, I don't think he's given up on that by any means. I think that this is – he's viewing this as an incremental march to that goal. And one thing that I left out is that, of course, whenever you talk about expanding sales taxes, Democrats on the other side go crazy because they say, you know, this is inherently unfair to lower income people. So you also have that piece of the fight. And then I think the other thing I would mention is that once this tax expansion and redistribution debate started here in the last couple weeks or so, McCrory gave a speech in Chapel Hill where he said, we cannot afford to have this bill passed. I mean, that's pretty strong language when you're talking about members of your own political party.
Which leads to the questions I asked him about his battles with the Senate, which we can talk about later. But let's stick with taxes for a second or two here. Last month, the Senate put forth a proposal that would change how sales taxes are distributed among counties around the state. It would shift money away from urban counties to help support more rural areas. What's the thinking behind this, and what are people thinking about the thinking behind all of this? I'm not sure which one of you to ask about that.
Well, I'll take just a first quick crack, and then these guys can correct me as I will need to be corrected. But in essence, what the Republicans who are supporting these bills want to do is they want to try and even out the landscape a little bit. And obviously, the urban areas are growing, Charlotte, Raleigh, and Asheville. And these rural counties don't have much prospect for new industry, for new jobs. They obviously don't take in nearly as much tax money. And so by reformulating how you distribute taxes. The idea is that this would maybe give them some life and
But do they need as much? They have smaller populations. They have less infrastructure to deal with. Do they need as much?
Well, I think it's fair to say by any measure that the rural counties are struggling. I mean, they're not doing as well. Their infrastructure is not as good if people who are driving on urban roads can believe that. So that is a legitimate argument. Now, how you solve that is a much thornier issue, and that's why we are where we are.
Tim?
There's also a fairness issue with this for some of these. Harry Brown, who's the majority leader from Monville County, is the one that brought forth this proposal. And his argument is that you have these people in the rural counties in North Carolina getting in their car, driving to these more urban areas to shop, and they're spending their money in those counties. And so they deserve some of that tax money back in their counties because they're the ones that are dragging in there. And they don't have the opportunity to raise sales taxes because they don't have shopping malls. They don't have tourist attractions. They don't have people coming in from out of state to do all that. So I think, you know, they are struggling. That there's a want to try to fix this problem. Senator Rucha has his own bill out now that, as Eric talked about, it does redistribute some of the sales tax but allows sales tax to expand the base, which allows more services, but that's not going to go over well in the House. I know for a fact that House Speaker Tim Moore does not like expanding to services. So this is a real convoluted issue, but the main argument as well is a fairness issue.
Hey, Harry Brown says that the current distribution scheme for sales taxes creates a vicious cycle that forces rural counties to fund their public schools and basic infrastructure needs through sky-high property taxes. And sky-high, this is a quote, and sky-high property taxes in much of rural North Carolina create another major obstacle to new industry locating and creating jobs here. And this is the big reason he says we have two North Carolinas, one that is booming and one that is busting. And I asked the governor about that. He took issue with the statement, saying that it smacked of the liberal tactic of accusing the other side of class warfare. Is this just another example of the friction between the governor's office and the Senate and Senate leaders, or is this a prime example of the internal struggle within North Carolina between East and West, rural and urban?
I think it's the latter.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, I mean, more so, I mean, Tim's right. I mean, there's obviously a lot of friction still between the governor and the Senate. When Tim Moore came in as speaker replacing Tom Tillis, a lot of people wondered if he was going to be able to help, you know, heal that relationship and make it less contentious between the governor and the Senate. But, you know, I personally think this boils down to a very simple internal struggle with Republicans, more about urban versus rural. You have Pat McCrory, an urban Republican, against, you know, the rural Republican Brown, who brought this up. It's kind of like it's our chance to get back at the big guys in a way.
Let me ask you, Tim, because you don't live in the great state of Mecklenburg.
I enjoy visiting that.
Yeah. Is this battle in the Republican Party over rural versus urban just that, or is it the fact that the urban areas like Mecklenburg, like Wake County, have more Democrats in them?
No, this goes way deeper than that. I mean, there's an ideological divide between the governor and the Senate, which has turned into a personal divide between the governor and the Senate, and the House has always been stuck in between. We do still have leadership in the legislature that is largely rural. But this issue of urban-rural divide has been brewing for some time. And incidentally, this is not just the North Carolina issue. The entire world is globalizing and urbanizing in a lot of ways. And so we have to answer these questions. These are tough questions. So there's only so many ways that you can fund. And in this state, you need permission from the state to raise taxes, essentially. So what the only ways that you can raise local taxes are through property taxes. Well, if it's so expensive to live there and there's right. no jobs, who the heck's going to live there?
Let me stop you there, Tim, because we have to take a break. That's Tim Boyum from Capital Tonight on Time Warner Cable News. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Henderson Properties, providing real estate sales and property management throughout the entire Charlotte region for over 25 years. HendersonProperties.com. And Live Nation, presenting Garrison Keillor's A Prairie Home Companion, The America the Beautiful Tour, August 14th at Uptown Amphitheater, Charlotte. Tickets available tomorrow, 10 a.m. at LiveNation.com. Next week, former General David Petraeus will come to Charlotte to be sentenced for his role in making classified information available to his biographer. His case has sparked debate about how we prosecute government officials, journalists, and others under laws like the Espionage Act and the Patriot Act. Take a look at those laws, why they were created, how they are used, and whether or not they're working. That's when Charlotte talks, Monday at 9, here on 90.7 WFAE.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. The 2016 presidential campaign begins in earnest. National protests for a $15 minimum wage heat up, and Boston marks the 2-year anniversary of the marathon bombings.
Join the Diane Rehm Show and the News Roundup this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Tim Boyum, anchor of Capital Tonight on Time Warner Cable News. That's on television, you know. Eric Spanberg is a senior staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal, and Tom Bullock is a reporter here for WFAE News, and we're talking about all the legislative going-ons in Raleigh this session. You just talked, Tim, about high property taxes in these rural areas having to fund a lot of things because they don't get the sales tax revenues that the urban areas get. Charlotte Mayor Pro Tem Michael Barnes said that stripping revenue from growing urban areas prevents them from investing in things like infrastructure to support their expanding populations. And if this pack, if this sales tax redistribution proposal passed, it would impact Charlotte. It would impact the Triangle. What are you hearing from politicians in these areas, all three of you, about this proposal?
Oh, well, of course, like Michael Barnes is saying, the rhetoric is good and amped up. This would be a second Great Recession, you know, run for your lives.
Ron Carley, the city manager, said it would be devastating.
Yeah, we should probably get, I guess, milk and eggs and bread. Don't we usually do that in case of a snowstorm? But it would be bad. I mean, it would cause a lot of havoc. And there's already a separate issue with a business tax that went away and the legislature did not replace it.
That's $65 million was lost in that. Yes,
As they promised, it is a lot of money. And I think it is a very real concern. And I would tie it back to some of what we were talking about earlier. While all these issues go deeper, as Tim and Tom have said, there is a lot of Democrat-Republican city versus state, you know, at work here. Because, I mean, look, in Wake County, where Tim does live and pay taxes, you know, they've basically revamped how the county commissioners are elected. Well, that was a clean sweep by Democrats. So there's, you know, there's a lot at play here. It's not just one thing.
Governor McCrory, go ahead. Tim, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that the hard part about this rural-urban issue is they're all right. I mean, these rural areas are struggling. They need money. These urban areas are growing and providing jobs. They need to keep their money. These are tough answers, and that's what the Republicans are learning, that governing is a lot harder than winning. And this isn't to say that Republicans are doing a bad job or they're having a harder situation than Democrats. The truth is these are some of the hardest decisions that the state has faced in some time. On top of, we have billions of dollars of infrastructure needs. We're in a real tough time of trying to figure this all out. Now, the liberals and the Democrats say that's why we need to raise more money, but then you're taking more money out of people's pockets, and we go round and round and round, and we end up right where we are.
And the governor has asked local mayors to come up with an alternative source of revenue to replace that business license tax revenue that they lost. Has any mayor been able to come up with an alternative plan?
No.
Do we know?
No, not that anyone's heard. And the mayor in Charlotte, Dan Clodfelter, who, of course, was part of the state Senate for many years, is very frustrated. And I think he's heading towards anger over the problems that have been created by his former colleagues.
And this is a man who actually is against the privilege license tax overall. He thinks it's a silly, outdated, antiquated law that really does need to be changed. But I also have to say, it seems like a bit of a political punt for sitting governor to ask local mayors to come up with a way to replace money that they get that was granted to them by the state. This was not a local tax.
Right. Where does the sales tax redistribution proposal stand at the moment?
Well, there are two different ones, as Tim mentioned, to make it just even a little more confusing. There's the one that Harry Brown introduced that would essentially start that split from zero, and then Bob Rucho would do it at a predetermined level of, I think, 2013-14 tax levels. And then go from there. So for those of you scoring at home, you're going to need a lot of notebooks to try and figure out exactly what you want to happen, what should happen, and what people are trying to make happen.
But I think it's fair to say that Senator Brown's proposal is, if it's not dead, it's on a significant pause. I mean, the governor told you, Mike, he said that, you know, the math here is bad. And one of the things they did to kind of show that this would not be such a huge hit to counties like Mecklenburg, like Wake, was they asked the Fiscal Research Division to project out how much of a percentage of sales tax overall would actually be lost by the urban and by the urban counties and gained by the rural counties. But if you look at the numbers, they asked the Fiscal Research Division to project out at economic growth at 3.5%. Now, that's incredibly rosy, all right? What they're thinking is the bigger the pie, even if your slice is a little bit smaller, you're still going to end up with about the same amount of pie. Yeah. I dug around to try to figure out exactly what our economic rate, you know, growth rate has been during the Carolina comeback. And the best years, I mean, 2011,
marks around that.
air quotes, Tim. I'm sorry you're on the phone. I do very good air quotes.
My chuckles are the air quotes. Sorry.
2011, economic growth of 1.8% in the state. 2012, the best year, 2.7%. And this projected out at 3.5. So as the governor told you, the math was bad. Mm-hmm. And everybody seems to kind of understand this may be too much too fast. So that is now on pause. Well, Rucho is still coming forward. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off. The other thing, too, is like a week after this was proposed, before it even hit a committee, there were two words, unintended consequences, that came out, which is the death knell of any bill. Nobody wants that. And this hadn't even been heard yet, that some cities and towns were impacted more than they thought. It wasn't just counties. And so I hate to sound like a pragmatist, but there are lots of ideas coming out. This seems just ripe for an idea that needs to be studied and several ideas brought forward before we do something so massive.
Well, speaking of unintended consequences, Indiana comes to mind. Again, we're going to shift gears here. And we had a proposed law very much like the one in Indiana surrounding same-sex marriage and religious freedom. There's a bill in both the House and Senate that appeared to be similar to that Indiana bill that would allow businesses to refuse service to anyone on religious grounds. Was this intended as an escape clause for businesses that don't want to take any part in gay marriage, or was there more to this than meets the eye?
Well, I think the first thing that that comes to mind for me is that Phil Berger, who is the president of the Senate and arguably the most powerful politician in the state, clearly has problems with same-sex marriage, breaking news. And so, you know, he has led the fight against the court decisions. He is in favor of the magistrates not, you know, on religious basis being able to refuse to conduct services. And so I think that from his standpoint and his allies, I think very much they were intending something very similar to what happened in Indiana.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I would actually say that it's the unofficial official rationale for what are known as the RFRA laws across the country.
Is this in response to the fact that Amendment 1, which North Carolina resoundingly passed, has effectively been neutered
absolutely
by the courts?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, from the time that the court decision came out, the one that effectively made same-sex marriage a go in North Carolina, mm-hmm. Phil Berger and people who agree with Senator Berger have been looking for ways to fight back.
In fact, they're still paying for a court case to try to challenge it.
I can tell you that week that went down, there was a plan to have North Carolina's version of that proposal in committee on that Wednesday. And then on Tuesday, Speaker Moore called reporters to his office, which is a very rare thing, and basically said he's been talking to CEOs of major companies, and for now, you know, we're just going to put this on pause. Mm. So it is a real, again, you know, you hate to keep harping on this, but it's sort of a divide within the Republican caucus. Again, there's those that are very focused on business and making sure that regulations aren't too high and, you know, jobs are coming to North Carolina. And then there's others that are more focused on social issues in addition and really believe that this is important. It'll be interesting to see if it does move forward, if there's a provision put in again to protect against discrimination.
Mm. And I think, Mike, you kind of got at this when you interviewed the governor. One of the most interesting things going on here as we all look ahead to 2016 is he's trying to navigate, you know, which side of the Republican Party he's with. But also, again, people don't pay close attention, and it's obvious why. It's so tangled. And so the question here is whether people are going to throw everything that's happened in the legislature onto McCrory's back and say, I don't know if I want to go there again. Or is he vocal enough and persuasive enough to say, hey, look, I'm not for all that.
Well, and I want to just – I'm sorry, Mike. I just want to add one more thing. Looking in possibly shorter term in the future than the 2016 election, this is also happening when the state is desperately trying to land Volvo to do a manufacturing plant here in North Carolina, something that the state has been trying to do forever, it seems. Mm-hmm. And when you look at the level of corporate reaction, not just in Indiana, but also in Arkansas, and granted, the Arkansas law is significantly, I would say it gives more, even more power for religious freedom than Indiana or North Carolina's proposed. Having that going through the system, I think they were frankly spooked of scaring away a car company.
Well, getting back to the governor and maneuvering in advance of the election and trying to maybe there are people who say that he's maneuvering toward the center because he has to face a statewide re-election.
Right.
He says he's – and this was surprising – that he's against this religious freedom bill, for lack of a better term. He says it deals with someone's motivation, a thought, not an action, and to regulate thought would be tantamount to the thought police envisioned by George Orwell. Well,
I guess the question is what they think. How do we know what they think? It's what people do. And in fact, I disagree with laws that we have in the criminal justice books about what people are thinking will determine their sentence when they commit a crime. It's the crime that made a difference, not what they were thinking when they committed the crime.
And he also said that he would refuse to sign a bill that would allow magistrates to opt out of performing same-sex marriages on religious grounds.
At this time, I would not sign it the way it's written because I don't and I've stated for the record, I don't think you should have an exemption or a carve-out when you swore an oath to the Constitution of North Carolina or to the Constitution of the United States of America.
Did either of these statements surprise anyone, fellow politicians, reporters, legislators, Republicans, Democrats? Did it surprise anybody that he said these things?
I don't think so, because I think we all recognize that Pat McCrory is not governor of a gerrymandered district. He's governor of a purple state. And so it would be very difficult for him to take the opposite view and have a realistic strong bid for re-election, in my opinion.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, go back again to when he first ran successfully for governor in 2012. And, you know, there was this that great moment in the debate that was moderated by Lisa Leslie where he was asked, what additional limitations would you sign into law on abortion? And he had a single word answer. None. This is somebody who has to appeal to a broad base, not just Republicans, not just, you know, independents or moderates. He's got to get everybody on his side, especially since it looks like he's going to be running against Attorney General Roy Cooper, who himself has been, you know, obviously setting up kind of a bright line on where he stands on social issues. The governor has to do the same.
So when
the other big question, though, is he said he wouldn't sign it. So what we have to watch for very closely is, if he doesn't sign it, it still goes into law. So then the question becomes, if he doesn't sign it, does he veto it? If he doesn't, what does that signal to independent voters as well? I mean, there's just so many fascinating questions. The governor's going to be put into a lot of uncomfortable positions, much like Tom Tillis was when he was running for U.S. Senate.
So when Republicans have taken over the legislature and are exercising their muscle after being in the wilderness for so long, and the locomotive is going full tilt boogie down the tracks, and they see what's going on in Indiana with a law that they want to pass, and they have to put the brakes on it, what is that telling them in Raleigh? Is it telling them anything, or is this going to eventually go through after a cooling off period? What's going to happen here?
That's a very good question.
Thank you.
I thought the same thing when you said. I thought the same thing that it would be interesting to see if this goes through or in cooling off period. Tim Moore has signaled in my eyes that he's very focused on recruiting jobs and business to the state. And you know, Indiana has now hired a PR firm. I read in a report to try to overcome what happened. I mean, if you're spending tax dollars on a PR firm to help you overcome something, it would be incredibly challenging. And Tom brought up the Volvo plant. I mean, I think the governor sees getting some massive plant to North Carolina as one of his prime achievements to being reelected as governor of the state. So it's going to be difficult, I think, regardless of the power of Senate President Pro Tem Phil Berger. I think there's enough Republicans that are against messing with economic development that it'll be interesting to see. But I think it'll cool down a little bit.
So the legislature has cut income taxes, or so they say. They have removed the business license tax from municipalities around the state and are considering the way state sales taxes are redistributed. They're also putting forward economic development plans that would lower corporate income taxes. And for some larger corporations, it would be at zero. What's the argument here? How would this boost economic development?
Well, first of all, Mike, when you said it's moving like a locomotive, I always picture the Chris Farley Saturday Night Live skit when he was playing Newt Gingrich and they would just hammer the table and everything was approved instantly. It feels like that. They had a century of pent-up demands, and by God, they're going to get after them. The argument, though, on the economic development and the lowering taxes is very straightforward. It's that when businesses have less of a tax burden, they will spend more on research and development and employees, and they will become more efficient, and everybody goes home with more money, and everything grows.
Or they think about relocating. I mean, it's basically think of the movie Field of Dreams, except here it's if you cut it, they will come. They will suddenly see North Carolina as the place to come because their bottom line is helped because, you know, their overhead with things like taxes would be lower.
Let me just interrupt for just a quick second. But by that measure, that argument, then, you know, South Carolina would be Silicon Valley at this point.
Yeah.
So does
– Yes, and that comes to the point where the taxes are only a portion of it. And the corporate tax is a little misleading because there are a lot of corporations in the state that don't even pay income tax because of carve-outs and other deals. But there are when you do surveys of companies and they list the things that are most important to them about coming to a state, taxes are like sixth or seventh on the list. Mm-hmm. It's become a huge discussion. But in some ways, it's a little bit of a ridiculous discussion. The North Carolina Chamber, I talk to them about this all the time. It's a package of issues that we need to work on together. And for whatever reason, there's an obsession with these taxes right now, but it is really just one small sliver of a massive
But isn't it true that any taxes a corporation pays are going to get handed over to the consumers? They're going to put it into the price of their product. And if that's true, how much impact does that have on a company's decision about whether to locate in a state or stay in a state?
I think a decision is more about the workforce than it is about the price of goods. You're talking about relocating. So you're talking about education, infrastructure, those types of things.
Can you drive to work? Do you want to put your kids in the local school? Is it a nice place to live?
So do corporate taxes have anything to do with anything at all, or is it a red herring?
I agree with Tim.
I think it's part of a pie, but... Go ahead.
Ironic since I'm actually agreeing with you. No, I think he's right. I think it's part of the piece. It's part of the picture, but it is certainly not the number one focus.
Okay. And I think it's very much overblown, and it's just turned into a source of constant rhetoric.
And the governor has said that this would break the bank and that it breaks the promises of last year's tax reform. What does he mean by that?
Well, one of the things he means by that is that they would go revenue neutral with tax reform, you know, that they would be able to have what they view as a reasonable budget and still fund it. And his concern is that if you keep cutting taxes, you don't have enough revenue and you can't pay for what you need to do, which includes, by the way, teacher pay raises and things like that, because Republicans, if there's an issue where Republicans really suffer, I think education is one of them. They've really been hit hard in campaigns. And so that's an area where they've really tried to shore things up, particularly Governor McCrory.
Yeah, and there is kind of a cautionary tale out there if you go too far with this. And it's happening right now in Kansas, where the governor there has, you know, followed what a lot of people see as a very good Republican playbook when it comes to cutting taxes and for just about everybody, and all the business was supposed to flock, and it hasn't happened yet.
Right.
Sam Brownback was just reelected, but, you know, there's a cautionary tale there that it may take more time or it may not happen at all.
And again, this is a fight between the governor and the House and the Senate, which we'll come back and talk about, among other things, in just a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the 20th annual Queen's Cup Steeplechase, Saturday, April 25th, with 5 live thoroughbred races and the Queen's Cup, followed by the Hot Walk Party. General admission badges at all Harris Teeter locations and at queenscup.org. And an evening with David Sedaris, April 20th at the Belk Theater, featuring the NPR personality and best-selling author. This evening of all new readings and recollections includes a book signing. Tickets at blumenthalarts.org.
Coming up next at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show, it's the Friday News Roundup. A panel of journalists will join Diane Rehm for analysis of the week's top national news stories, including the 2016 presidential campaign beginning in earnest, national protests for a $15 minimum wage heating up, and Boston marking the two-year anniversary of the marathon bombings. That's the Diane Rehm Show and the News Roundup at 10 here on 90.7 WFAE.
Peter Sagal here. You and I know that the most important NPR show is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the news quiz. But if you want to do well at it, you have to study up. So get a notebook, find a quiet room, and listen to Morning Edition every day. It's everything you need to know to succeed at Wait, Wait, except for stories about exploding pants. So start your Monday with Morning Edition, and then find some other place to hear stories about exploding pants.
That's Morning Edition, Monday from 5 until 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about what's going on in the legislature this year with three people who know it well because they cover it for their respective news organizations. Tom Bullock from WFAE News, Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal, where he is senior staff writer, and Tim Boyum, who's the anchor of Capital Tonight on Time Warner Cable News. It's a statewide program, and he talks almost exclusively to these legislators up in Raleigh. This economic incentives and cutting business taxes is a Senate proposal. It's a rejection of a package that was put forth by the governor and the House. Is this another example of House and Senate versus or the governor and the House versus the Senate? And is this kind of power struggle typical in a government controlled exclusively by one party?
Ding, 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 ding. Tell him what he's won. The answer is yes to all of those things. And again, as Tim and Tom have talked about, it's fascinating to watch because whenever a political party gets all the cards, they struggle to figure out how to share them. And this economic development issue has been one that's gone on and on, still is not resolved. And one of the many interesting things about it to me is that you have groups like Civitas, which is a very right-leaning group, and you have liberal groups who just sort of throw up their hands and say, we don't really like incentives. We don't see much evidence that they're successful. Mm-hmm. But I think that the mainstream Republican and Democrat and business leadership would say, we have to do something. Everybody else does it. Let's get this shored up. But they can't agree yet.
Let's talk about another kind of incentive that's pretty much gone away in North Carolina. I don't know whether they talk about this, Tim, in Wake County, because I don't know how much TV and film production has been done there. But Charlotte was home to Banshee and to Homeland. And Wilmington, of course, is clinging by their fingernails to the CBS show Under the Dome because all these incentives have gone away. But Under the Dome has stayed. Is there talk elsewhere in the state about the loss of these incentives and about the loss of jobs by people who made their living as ancillary people in the film industry, whether they be caterers or chauffeurs or set builders or grips?
Yes, there is discussion about it. And the hard part about this discussion is, look, filmmaking, it's a sexy thing to have all these movies in town, but I would caution people to look at it this way. If it was a cement industry that was in North Carolina, and we gave $65 million to just the cement companies, what would people think about it? That's sort of where some of the Republicans are coming from. This is a principled issue, much like the historic tax credit. You know, why do we give tax credits to one industry and not the other? And why does one get more than the other? There are bills that have been filed to talk about this. Some people just want to continue the $10 million grant funding program, although as we just thought, it was only three projects and the money is out already for through July this year. There's a bill to continue the grant program, which is different than the incentive program, and it would put in $66 million. So put in over 6.5 times the money that it had this year. I don't know where it's going to go, to be honest. I mean, that is really up in the air as we move forward. There's such a strong focus on the larger, what's known currently as JDIG, which are the money for the bigger companies to come in. So it's getting sort of lost in the mix right now, but it is being discussed among lawmakers up here, and there are some powerful ones at that.
Let's talk about something that started happening soon after the Republicans took control of the House and Senate. And Republicans have a reputation for not liking federal officials coming into the states and telling them what to do. And yet the Republican legislature almost immediately went into local municipalities. They took over the airport in Asheville. They're still trying to take over the airport in Charlotte. They took over a water system someplace, forgotten where now. But now the General Assembly has set its sights on local redistricting. They've gone after changing how the Wake County Board is elected. State Senator Chad Barefoot, the Republican sponsor of the bill, said at the time he was trying to bring more fairness to a system in which the deck was stacked in favor of urban voters at the expense of those in suburban and rural areas. They have since turned their attention to Greensboro and Cabarrus counties. Could Charlotte be next? What's going on here?
Well, and remember, they also had the Wake School Board fight that still is not completely resolved. And there has been talk, Mike, about whether the Mecklenburg County commissioners might be chosen in some new and novel way that I suspect might be more GOP-friendly. It's interesting. I remember speaking to former state legislator Ruth Samuelson about the very question or the issue that you raised, which is, well, wait a minute, I thought Republicans were all about local control, and this was in regard to the airport fight that will never end. And she said, well, yes, we are, but when things are not being run well by the local group, then we have to step in. That's part of our responsibility. So I think that's the basic take in Raleigh is that, look, we don't want to interfere, but some of these cities are not managing this in an effective way, and so we have to look out for the taxpayers in North Carolina.
Is that true, or is it simply the fact that because of the census, the Republicans were able to redistrict the state, and now they want to go in and take these blue counties and make them more Republican? It's all about...
Mike, it's like you've done this before. You seem to be right on it. Absolutely.
I mean,
that's
don't vote. Don't,
right.
If that is in fact what it is, don't voters see through that?
Well, I think that a lot of that will be answered in 2016, won't it? When we'll have the next statewide election. The problem, though, here is that these districts are so safe, whether we're talking about Democrats or Republicans, that it's really hard it's hard to change the makeup. And so that's why we have extreme ideology, and that's what fuels a lot of these fights or exacerbates a lot of these debates.
And I think it all matters on perspective. I know that sounds a bit cliche when we're talking about politics, but it's absolutely true. I mean, if you take Wake, some of the news reports that I read about the redistricting there, you had some people in kind of the suburban and rural areas around it who were, you know, perturbed by the fact that their commissioner was decided just by an urban core, and that their votes essentially were just diluted to the point where they may or may not have mattered. It is really about perspective. I don't think that they're doing this out of malice. I don't think that it's happening just as a mass power grab. But it is something – it's a bit of a flip of Republican ideology that can be surprising. It is absolutely starting to reach out and take over local control from a party that has classically said we are for smaller government and local independence.
Mm-hmm. Just two things on this real quick. I mean, timing is everything in politics. What Barefoot did in Wake County, a lot of people could argue, does make some sense, even if you disagree with it, just on a philosophical level. But to do it just months after – Democrats took over the Wake County Commissioner, obviously makes it look political. I've had numerous Republicans tell me on the show, yes, it clearly looks political, but we feel like we need to make the change. The other thing is we're what's called a bill and rule state. So more so than a lot of other states, the state has a significant amount of control and power over municipalities. Now, you can argue whether you should or should not do that, but that is the reality of the situation, and they feel they need to change things that they believe are not fair.
Do the cities and do the municipalities have any recourse if this happens and they disagree with it?
None.
They can't go to the courts.
Tim makes the most important point, which is the power of the state government over local government.
Now, they could dissolve the city of Charlotte if they wanted to.
What Dylan Rule means is that all local authority is vested to that authority by the state. They control it overall. So everything is just like a little subdivision of the state government.
So that's enshrined in the state constitution. Therefore, they have no recourse.
Mm-hmm. Right. Based on U.S. Supreme Court cases.
Okay. Here's another example that has nothing, I don't think, to do with politics. But it's another example of the state sticking its fingers into the pie. There was a story in the paper on Thursday about the state aiming to regulate Uber and Lyft. It says for more than a year, the city of Charlotte has struggled with how it should regulate cars and drivers of share ride companies such as Uber and Lyft. And now there's new legislation proposed in the General Assembly that would take the issue entirely out of Charlotte's hands and put the regulation with the state. Why do they want to get involved in that?
I mean, I do think that a lot of this comes down to power. I truly believe that. I mean, the cities and the – not just Charlotte, but the big cities and state government just do not agree on much. They don't get along very well. And we're just seeing this. You just ran through the list, Mike. I mean, we're seeing this over and over again. So I don't see it as that big a surprise. And also, you have the tied-in factor of Uber and Lyft are creating legislative headaches across the country.
That's true. I mean, and you know, here at the Charlotte Airport, they're already trying to figure out how or if they should regulate Uber and Lyft, since they aren't officially an on-demand service. They work in kind of a gray area. And airports around the country are doing that. I mean, Los Angeles, I believe Seattle, I believe San Francisco. I mean, there's quite a few that are
trying to... But airports around the country are trying to figure it out, not state legislatures.
Well, South Carolina. I mean, South Carolina, I believe, has some pretty strict – I think Uber actually is not allowed currently to operate.
That's right.
Because it's all part of a new economy, right? This is the shared economy. It's a right. different kind of thing. And part of it is trying to regulate. Part of it is just trying to understand exactly right. where it fits in. And I frankly think that part of it may be future revenue streams.
Well, here's something.
Well, Uber has plenty of lobbyists at the legislature. I will just guarantee it right now. I don't know for a fact, but I'm going to guarantee it right now.
Well, here's something. Go ahead.
Uber does not want to be handled like taxis. They believe that they're different than taxi cabs. And so I'm sure there's a push at the state. And let's be honest, most state lawmakers probably don't understand what Uber is in the first place. So they want to make sure they have their hand on fixing it.
So, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's like their German second language course.
So here's something I read in the paper on Thursday that I also don't understand at all. Tom Apodaca, is that how you say his name, Tim?
Yeah.
He's the senator from Henderson County, a Republican who chairs the Senate Rules Committee, wants to eliminate the state's certification or the certificate of need laws that govern hospitals. I'm not sure what this means. I read it twice. Still don't understand it. The hospitals are not in favor of this, and they're afraid that smaller hospitals would be hurt more than bigger hospitals. And if I understand this correctly, in states where this has happened, this same kind of a thing has happened, healthcare costs have risen.
So
does anybody know anything about
well.
This?
So a lot of people want to get rid of it. It's a free market, right? I mean, you need to go to the state to ask permission to add beds or have beds at a facility right now. Tom Apodaca believes in a free market, much like a lot of Republicans do, that you want to open up a hospital and you can provide beds. It's up to you to provide service. Now, what the hospitals are saying is this could, you know, have a lot of excess room and equipment that's unnecessary, and then the quality of care goes down at that point. Now, let's be honest, big corporations in general don't like to have a lot of new competition. So I think, again, this is another one of those free market questions. Although I will say this is not, again, broken record here, this is not a all Republicans are in on this issue. This is a split issue as well. This has been brewing for some time, and I think this is going to be a long discussion.
Okay. Gasoline taxes. Gasoline prices have been falling for months now, mercifully, and with them tax revenues, of course, they've been declining. And even as that has been happening, House and Senate leaders announced a deal last month to gradually reduce the gasoline tax. Can we afford that? Anybody want to tackle that? Can we afford that?
Well, go ahead, Tim.
I was going to say that the one word here, I was hyphenated, I guess, Band-Aid. This is a temporary stabilization. The rates would have actually gone lower because of the price of wholesale prices. So they're saying, what they're saying is we're stabilizing the price because the gas tax would have actually gone lower. But after 3 years, it goes back to market, which means it will increase after, you know, these increased decreases are put in place. What they're really trying to do is just put something in to stabilize it until they can get a very long-term deal in place. Gasoline taxes, the revenues have been decreasing because their cars are getting more efficient. People are riding in electrical cars, all that kind of stuff. And so it is a really huge problem. The bottom line is no, we cannot afford to have less revenue from gas taxes, but we have to figure out how to replace them. This is a much larger problem than a gasoline
Tom?
Tax.
Yeah, and I mean, without the gasoline tax, it's the number one funder for the Department of Transportation. Without the gasoline tax, you don't get the roads, you don't get the bridges, you don't get the things that you need for your cars
Which
to work.
Which is why somebody's suggesting a fee.
Yes, exactly. But, you know, the thing I find interesting about the gasoline tax, and I realize it's not the sexiest subject to talk about, but this program we've been talking about, this kind of cold war, if not a hot war, between the Senate, the House, and the governor. And this is an instance where they actually all kind of negotiated, came to a consensus. And even though Tim's right, it's a Band-Aid, at least it was something that stopped a much larger decline. And I found that to be really interesting because, number one, it happened. Number two, it happened pretty early in the legislative season. This is not the kind of deal that's laid out way, way back, you know, when they're trying to wrap everything up. And if you think about last session, you know, think about Medicaid, think about coal ash, think about teacher pay. Teacher pay, they finally got an agreement on. Ish, but you know, Medicaid and coal ash, terrible. They could not really come up with any kind of a negotiation. They worked together on this, and even though it's a temporary fix, they got something.
Yeah, I think the biggest issue with this is the way it was presented or the way it was sold. But you know, the basics of the problem of gas taxes and the infrastructure issue, I mean, this is something that goes far beyond Republicans and Democrats or even North Carolina. This is going on all over the country. And Tim, you laid it out in terms of the fuel efficient cars and the lack of money to repair roads and bridges.
So we have 90 seconds.
Let me just put this in perspective. We're talking about a few million dollars here and there. Mm. We have over $65 billion in needs by 2030 to keep up with growth in the state. So that's what I'm talking about when I say it's a Band-Aid.
So let's talk about energy in the time we have left, which is about a minute here. We are the fourth largest state in the country in terms of solar energy. And now a bill sponsored by two chairs of the House Public Utilities Committee wants to cut our target for becoming even more solar oriented in half. Why? Is this the influence of Duke Energy?
This all goes back to the rates, basically. It's how much that utility companies have to pay people who have what's called rooftop solar in their houses.
Right.
They have to buy it at the retail rate. The utilities want it at the wholesale rate because it's cheaper and it's actually what they pay power plants to do it. The thing that's interesting here is this is complicated. This is a mess. And both sides, the utility companies and the environmentalists, they both pretty much hate this bill.
That was very well done.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
15, 20 seconds, so I'm not going to try and interfere with that, Mike.
Then we'll let him have the last word. And he works here, too. That's Tom Bullock from WFAE News, Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer from the Charlotte Business Journal, and Tim Boyum, anchor of Capital Tonight for Time Warner Cable News, on vacation, but you can see him back next week, I take it. Thank you all for thank you all for the hour.
Thank you.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. Our producers are Aaron Kiever and Tim Ross. Our associate producer is Alexia Girodi, and the engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information,